She learned how to wear a mask long before she ever wore a uniform. She served 17 years in the Army, rose to the rank of major, and looked like she had it all together. But underneath the surface, she was battling anxiety, depression, and unresolved trauma. The military gave her a purpose, but it also taught her to suppress pain until it nearly consumed her. This isn't just a story about service. It's about survival, identity, and finally finding the courage to take the mask off. This is a must hear. Welcome to season 5 of Dog Tag Diaries, where the untold stories of military women take center stage. I'm your host, Captain Kim, and we are in our 5th season. 5 seasons of truth, grit, laughter, healing, and connection. To every storyteller who shared a piece of their soul, and every listener who's walked alongside us, thank you. You're the reason this podcast has grown into a movement. Let's keep breaking silence, building community, and amplifying the voices that deserve to be heard. Let's dive in. This week on Dog Tag Diaries, we welcome Army veteran and mental health advocate Annette Wittenberger. A former major who served over 17 years, Annette is the voice behind A Wild Ride Called Life and author of the bestseller, The Wall Between Two Lives. From military life and motherhood to mental health and healing, Annette shares her powerful journey of transformation and truth. Annette, welcome to Dog Tag Diaries.
Thank you so much. Such an honor.
Thank you for taking time to be here. I know you've been super busy because you're down in Texas.
I am, yes.
And let's tell the viewers what you've done over the weekend to help with the catastrophe that hit down there.
Yeah, no. So Saturday, you know, it was a last minute thing, but you know, everything, it's not like this is planned, right? So you have a friend say, hey, I want to go to Kerrville tomorrow. I'm like, let me know what you need. Cancel everything. Let's see what we can do. And so we drove 2.5 hours down there and got them all the supplies that we could possibly get. So we get down there and, you know, the community is such a small town. So the community is just overflowing with truckloads of things and then supplies. It's just, yeah.
From all the flooding, correct?
From all the flooding, yes. And so the Salvation Army down there was collecting things. So people coming in the truckloads in line, just trying to get there to donate. I mean, it came to a point where they couldn't accept donations anymore. They're like, we've got so much. Thank you. But the thing of it is that, you know, when something like this happens, everyone wants to do right now. But we have to remember, and this is what they said, is we don't want to be forgotten next week or in 2 weeks. So please come back next week or in 2 weeks or in 3 weeks, because that's when we're going to still need supplies. So it was just an overwhelming experience, but it's also so heartwarming to see the community come together. So yeah, it was just a lot.
Yeah. And that, like we were talking before we started recording the podcast, and it's just who you are. You do these selfless acts and you really are this huge advocate for our military woman community, number one, but really for all humans who may need help and direction. And so I want to dive into who you are, and I want to start from the beginning. Like, who were you as a little girl, Annette?
So I grew up in Southern California in a small town called Simi Valley. And growing up in the 80s, everything is just, it's in the newspaper, right? You don't hear about anything else. You just play outside till the lights come on. And that's how I was raised. So just shielded from the wrongdoings that happen in life. And so I myself went through a traumatic experience as a child, but my mom did the best she could to get me therapy from being sexually assaulted by my best friend's father. So I became one of those people who learned how to black things out. I suppressed a lot of things as a child into my teenage years. And then going into the military, I just learned how to put on a different hat, put on a smile, and just continue on. And, you know, you can only do that for so long, but that's what I learned to do.
Yeah, well, with a traumatic experience like that, I would think that
as a child, we don't know what's happening to us, but we know that something doesn't feel right. Is that what you felt when you went through that experience?
I did. I'm a people pleaser sometimes. And so when something happens, I feel like, well, I don't want to get anybody in trouble. I don't want to make anybody mad. So unfortunately, it took 2 times for this incident to happen for me to go, okay, I think I need to say something. And, you know, and that's just how I dealt with things is I knew something was wrong, but I don't want to make anybody mad. But I was 10. And at that point, and I didn't even realize till maybe 6 months ago that I really started advocating from the time I was 10 years old. And I didn't realize it because, like I said, I suppressed a lot and I blacked it out. I was just one of many girls that were involved in that assault over a period of time. But I was given an opportunity to testify in court and I did it. I still don't really comprehend how all that happened, but I did. I testified in court because the other children were scared. You know, we're 10. And I don't remember what happened in court necessarily, but I do remember that he only went away for 9 months. And I lived in fear for years because I switched schools and I no longer had the same friends. And I was always looking over my shoulder, you know, always wondering if he was there. And then when I found out that he was released, that's when I just blacked out a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah. One, I'm so sorry that happened to you and a few of your friends. That should never happen to anyone. And you had to live in survival mode, which really is our body's way of natural fight, flight, or freeze, which is wonderful when you need to get out of harm's way. But when it's elongated, man, that mentally and physically exhausts you. Did you feel that in your body and your mind?
I mean, I think I did because that's just how I lived the rest of my life until my 40s. Because that's just what I did it then, and it worked. So I'm just going to continue doing it.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just what we know.
Yes, it is.
So did you have the support of your mom and dad through that whole event?
I did. As soon as I reported the incident, it was like automatic. We have to call the cops. My stepdad was there at the time. I just remember telling them that something had happened, and I said something, immediate cops, and then it was just like, I don't remember what happened next. I really don't. But I know that I was just protected in every way possible. And now as I became a parent, I know why I parented in fear, right? Because I was like, I can't let this happen to my kids. And if you ask my kids now, they'll be like, Mom was so strict. But I know why I was, and I try to be lenient. But anyway, it's just, you know, I don't remember what happened next. I just remember that I did go to therapy, but not for very long. I don't remember why. Therapy wasn't the same back then as it is now, right? So I don't remember how long I went for or why I stopped, but I just continued to live my life the best way that I knew how as a kid.
Yeah, and it had to be traumatic for your parents to hear that as well. So I'm sure that being new to them as well, they tried to do the best they could with what they knew and the tools that they had at the time as well. I'm glad that they were supportive of you.
Absolutely. They believed me. There was no question of, are you sure? It was like, okay, what are we going to do next?
Were either one of your parents in the military?
No. So it wasn't until years later that I found out that my grandfather, my dad's father, served in the Peruvian Air Force. I didn't get to meet him, though, because he died when my dad was 11. So I never got to know him. And it was said that he had died from complications from a bullet wound for many, many years. So I never got to really dig into that. And my uncle, my dad's sister's husband, who's now since deceased, he served in the same brigade that I served in. So it was just like this whole full circle of things that I never really knew about. And I wish I would have cared more about the history of my family. But, you know, you're growing up as a kid, you're like, yeah, it's whatever, you know. And later you're like, oh, my gosh, this is so fascinating. And so, yeah, I didn't grow up being surrounded by the military at all.
So how did you find the military?
I attended an all-girl Catholic high school from 7th to 12th grade. I had a friend, and I love talking about her. We still laugh about it to this day. She was such a badass. She enlisted out of high school. And I looked at her like, dang, that is so cool. I don't know why I thought it was so cool. It was so cool because it was unheard of. A lot of my friends went on to, you know, top tier schools from high school. And I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And a recruiter came to the house, and me and my little boyfriend at the time were sitting at the table. And I looked over at him and I said, should I do it? I don't know if I should do it. And the recruiter is just looking at me and I'm like, oh, yeah, I can't do it. I can't do it. And so that didn't happen at that moment, but it was stuck in my mind for such a long time, and I regret it. I mean, I don't regret the decision I made, but at that moment, I just felt like, man, I was such a baby, and why didn't I sign the contract? And so stuck in my mind, but I wasn't mature enough to do anything. So I went to community college for a year and a half, and the school that I had sought out afterwards was for a boy. But I made sure that they had an ROTC program. I just knew I had to try it out somehow. And so the Reserve Officer Training Corps was offered at Arizona State University. And I applied to the school. I got in and I did the ROTC thing. I said, you know what? By the time I got to this university, if you don't know how ROTC works, there's like military science 1, 2, 3. By the time I transferred to the university, I was already a sophomore. And so I was jumping in the middle mark and was like, I'm just going to try it out. I'm going to try it out because I didn't know what the heck I was doing in my life. And the third year comes along and they asked, they're like, you got to make a decision. You're either going to join the Army or not. I was like, okay, let's try it out for 3 years. 3 years turned into 17 plus.
Yeah, let's hear about that. Where did you go to basic? Where did you do your AIT?
So I had married my husband my senior year of college. He was a Gold Bar recruiter. So he was one of those guys who had already graduated from the program from school and just was in charge of recruiting the rest of us crazies. And I was like, I'm just going to follow him around, I guess. So I graduated college. I went to Fort Lewis, Washington. I hit ground in Washington. I'm in the airport and I called him and I said, I can't, what am I doing? I want to go home. He's like, you're not going home. You need to do this. You wanted this. You're going to do it. I hate it. I don't know what I'm doing. And so I just did it. I had to do it, but I was just so, everybody there knew what they wanted. I didn't know what I wanted. So I survived. I just had to make it through. I had to figure out how I was going to graduate from this advanced campus, what they called it. I never camped in my life as a kid. So my first time camping was sleeping in a tent in the middle of nowhere, pitching tents in next to 5 foot high ant piles. I just don't know how I did it.
It's a culture shock.
It's such a culture shock. I just feel like I was so shielded. That's a kid. And here I am, think I'm going to join the Army. Have no idea what I'm doing. No training, no nothing. So I survived it, obviously, but good grief. It was every day I was just like in tears and I couldn't cry in front of my peers. In fact, you were on a voting system and your peers, and I did not get voted often. I was just one of those weak ones, the weaklings in the group. And so I just had to make it through. I was not going to fail. I was not going to fail.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like that's in your gene pool to fail.
I just can't. I'm stubborn, though.
So what was your job description?
So when I commissioned as a chemical officer. And a lot of people say, ask me, what is that? Because there's no chemical warfare, thank God, right? We didn't have to deal with that. But we were the guys that everybody hated because you had to put the whole mop suit on, the mask, the whole suit, the one you sweat in, the one you go into the chambers in, the CS chambers. Those are the things that we did. And it's funny because I loved it.
You were in charge of giving us the different levels of mop gear? Oh!
I learned to just go, all right, let's do it. And it was stupid. It was stupid. But I loved going in with my soldiers. I went in with them and I just did the thing. But you know, we only did that once a year. So the other times I was actually given opportunities to work in other sections with logistics and personnel and training. So, you know, it was a curse. It was a blessing. It was one of those things. I learned a lot of other things because I didn't get to do my job all the time.
Yeah. Isn't that the fantastic thing about the military, though? You get an array of training. And so, yeah, it really, you're like, why am I learning this? But later on in life, you realize you're like, oh, this really comes in handy. I'm glad I did learn it.
I know. It's really funny. So when I picked off, you get like 6 choices at that time for females. So I picked, you know, medical corps, military intelligence, military police, engineer. A chemical was my very last one. I was like, I do not want this. And I actually got branch detailed military intelligence. So after 2 years, I got the notification, hey, you are able to transfer to MI now. But I turned it down because I had a 1-year-old and I was in Germany. I was like, do I do this one thing that I really wanted to do and fly back to the States? Or do I stay here and raise my daughter? So, you know, those are the sacrifices not a lot of people talk about. So I turned it down.
Well, let's talk about it because it really does pull on your heartstrings. And I can only attest to what you're saying because I was a single mom too. And I loved being a combat medic. And then I got my degree and went into flight nursing. And I loved it. And I was like, my goodness, they train you so well in the military. And you think, I can be that person to help bring those soldiers home to their families. At the same time, I decided to have a kid. Where, what's more important? And how did you feel about all of it?
So, you know, I'll be honest, I kind of resented my ex-husband because we were dual military. I was young. You know, I moved to Germany when I was 23, had my daughter at 25 and my son at 28. And he was about 18 months senior ranking to me. And so because he knew what he wanted to do with his career, I was like, okay, I'm going to support him. I don't know what I'm doing. We're just going to support what you're doing. But at the same time, I still want to do my thing, even though I don't know what the thing is. So, but I knew I wanted to be a platoon leader. I didn't get to do that. I knew I wanted to be a company commander. I did get to do that. But it was just those little things in your career that I was like, well, someone's got to raise these kids. And I almost felt like, well, because I'm wishy-washy with my life, I guess I'll just stay behind, so to speak. And it wasn't until later on in my career I was like, you know what? This kind of sucks. Not the kids, of course.
Of course.
But it sucks that I have to make these decisions. Because the military doesn't really say, oh, you know what? You tell us when you're ready. No, it's either now or never, you know? And so I had to make decisions like that for the rest of my career.
Did you get out of the military then and then return back in?
No. So I stayed. And then at my 17-year mark or 16-and-a-half-year mark is when I didn't get selected for promotion to lieutenant colonel. You know, and I think that's when it really hit me where I was like, this sucks because I could have done certain things, but I was raising kids. I know God had a plan for me later. You know, it's been 8 years now. And so I know at that moment he was like, you're going to do something else. And it's just hard for me to accept because I was like, this, why didn't I get promoted? Why this person? Why not me? And it's just one of those things where I tell people, it's hard, but we can't determine our self-worth off of a piece of paper. Unfortunately, that's what the Army does. So if you get out like I did, I had 6 months to get out. And I was like, this is bullshit. Like any other 20-year retirement person gets a whole year. You know, you can get up to 2 years. I got 6 months. And so in 6 months, I was like, what the F am I going to do? you know, I had a plan. I was like, all right, I'm getting out. I'll come back and work as a GS, or I'll be a contractor, or I'll do all these things. But when it was that time, at that 17-year, four-month day, they handed me the flag and the box with the certificate. And I was like, oh my God, this is, wow. Okay, this is it. No, like, high five, no, nothing. I didn't even go to my retirement ceremony. I didn't even go. No, because I was so embarrassed. I was so ashamed. I felt like such a failure. And unfortunately, at that moment, where I retired out of, where I worked at, the JRTC building on Fort Polk, because of my ex-husband was a battalion commander at the time, we lived across the street. So I was reminded every day until we PCS that that is where I just left. I didn't want to go back there to go to a retirement ceremony. There was no way. And do I regret that part? Yeah, I regret that. I wish my kids could have seen that. But I was absolutely mortified that I couldn't make it until at least 18 years to carry on the rest until 20. I was mad at the world. It was everybody's fault at that moment. Everybody's fault. And so it took me a long time to come to grips with, all right, this is my next gig. What am I going to do?
Yeah. And what did you do? You wrote books. You advocated for veterans. You advocated for yourself. But let's talk about that transition, because like you said, it was not easy getting out of the military, reintegrating back into a world that's so unfamiliar to you.
Yeah. I had to learn that I was still a mom. You know, my kids were 16 and 14 at that time. I still had to show up for them. And this was my moment to show up to all their games now. You know, there was no excuse. I went to every game possible that I could go to. I didn't have to worry about taking time off anymore. I was like, all right, I'm just going to do what I want to do now. But I turned to social media because that was what we did. Even now, you know, we turn there because we almost want to have someone tell us it's okay. But, you know, I got scrutinized a little bit because I used Facebook as my platform.
Wait, you got scrutinized by who? You mean the public?
Yeah, the public. Like, why are you, you know, why are you talking about this all over Facebook? And it's fine. Because listen, girl, I was like, all right, I'm going to create a website. And so I hired another veteran who had done one of my other soldiers' websites. And I said, let's do it. Let's create a whole freaking blog. And that's what I did. I created a whole blog. It's still up now. And I just shared my story there. That was my platform because I knew there was someone else out there. Somebody else had to have some type of rough transition like me. I know I'm not the only one. And that's just how it started. You know, I had other soldiers reach out to me like, ma'am, thanks for talking about it. It was hard. And I just knew then. I was like, okay, this is going to stay. And that's what I did. I used that as a platform. Then I created a podcast. And it's funny because my very, very first podcast was only 4 episodes. I never published it because I sounded so sad. I sounded so sad. I was like, I can't do this. This is sad. And I probably should have released it, but I don't think I was ready. I think I was using that recording to just get my feelings out. And I started the actual podcast in 2019. So after I had PCS is when I started it. And I was like, all right, I think it's time.
And it's helpful, isn't it? Just like you said.
It is.
That trauma, I honestly believe, does get trapped in our bodies. And there's so many ways to release it. But talking about it, just like you were saying, like, you sounded sad. Yeah, you showed up how you felt.
You're right.
And I love that you did that. And now what's your podcast called?
So back then it was The Truths We Hide. I did. So it's still on Spotify. I don't do any more recordings because I work with the magazine now. So I use that as a different platform. But, you know, I did 147 episodes, I think. And I said it was a good run, you know, and anybody listens to those anymore, then and great. But I will leave it up there forever just in case, you know, someone wants to hear it or learn something from it.
Yeah. Annette, I'm super proud of you. I'm going to call it a revolution, but I'm going to call it a net illusion because really it is. It's about when you start that process of bearing your soul, that vulnerability where you're like, ah, is anyone really going to want to hear this? And then you get all that, those positive comments like, oh my gosh, thank you, because I'm not alone. I thought I was dealing with this all by myself, which then makes you feel depressed and isolated. And God forbid you go down the way of taking your own life. We're not alone. And so I love that you were able to start that and really 100 and some episodes. Do you know how many people's lives you probably touched? Yeah. And from that, you went and wrote a book and you now write on a magazine. Let's talk about all that.
In 2021, I had met a couple people that said, you should write a book. I think we tell that to a lot of people. You should write a book. And then you're thinking, there's no way. There's no way. I worked with an editor, a friend. I took one of her workshops and I created a couple of chapters. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I should. Maybe I need to put this out there to help someone else. And, you know, I did. So the trauma I went through as a child, I never went back to go through those findings, right? So what I did was, in order for me to write this book, not just based off of some memories here and there, I actually got a hold of that police department and they mailed me my records. That was really hard, but I wanted to make sure I was putting correct details, not just of little flashes here and there, because I was best friends with his daughter at that time. I don't know if she'll ever, you know, we'll ever find each other again, but I felt bad for her and I had to make sure my statement was correct. I could sit here and say, I don't give a shit what I say about him. He was a bad person. I still felt like I needed to be respectful to her. It was her dad. And so it was very important for me to go through those records and cite the right details and not just based off of how I felt. So I did that and I reached out to him. You know, my dad got remarried and I'm close with his sons and I wanted to make sure it was okay for me to talk about them. You know, and I wanted to make sure it was okay for my other family members to be mentioned. And it was just very rough to write that book. And there's a lot of people out there now who say, well, it was yours, you know, it's my story. I'm going to write what I want. I get that and it's totally fine. But for me, it was important to respect my family members. It's just people pleaser. We go back to the people pleaser.
And it shows, Annette, it shows a lot about your character. You're empathetic, you're kind. And yeah, you call it people pleasing, but really it is about, it's just your heart and your soul. I mean, we all are still human. Yes, people do bad things and there's bad degrees of it. But the fact that you were able to sit there and be like, wait a second, I really need to make sure that I take everyone's feelings into consideration was really brave of you. And getting your records from being sexually assaulted at 10 years old, very dedicated to the mission and the journey that you were about to embark on. How was that for you? Did you end up getting a counselor to help you through that?
Not really. I think I just, with this whole, you know, the blog thing and the book thing, it was just part of my self-healing journey. And I, although it was difficult, because even my, you know, my husband at the time was like, are you sure you want to do that? You know, isn't that, that's a lot. And I said, no, I need to. I haven't gone back and looked at it. I saved it, but I didn't go back and look at it. I just, not since I wrote the book. So it's there, but it's not part, it doesn't define me anymore. You know, so I'll go back really quick. I did a talk a few years ago in California, and my audience was a mix of retirees and soldiers, civilians, and I talk a lot about how God, you know, he does things for us, not to us. And unfortunately, that does not apply to everything, because I still don't understand why God does what he does, right? Or why things happen. For me, he didn't do that assault to me or for me. I think that I went through it so that maybe I can help other people later. And so the civilian asked me, he says, well, you talk about how God, you know, he does these things for you, but how do you explain what happened to you? And I say, you know, I can't explain why that happened to me. I just know that right now I can help other people, you know, with my kids or just other people who have gone through it and don't talk about it until decades later in their life. I don't have an answer. I just know that I survived a lot. That was just the beginning of how my life was going to be. I've survived suicidal ideations and, you know, going to the dark place. And I've survived a lot of it. And I want to say I don't know how, but I know that God, he was, obviously I'm here for a reason still, you know? And so it's just really difficult to sit here and try to explain why things happen. But I just know for me that this is who I am now, you know, and that's not going to take over my life anymore.
And that's powerful because you just inspired me with that statement. You did, because sometimes we really get caught in, why is this happening to me? This doesn't feel good. Instead of you see like that big bright light at the end of the tunnel going, I don't know why it happened. And I don't have to have an answer, but all I know is that you were put in that situation for a reason and you found the reason. You found the reason. You wrote about it. You started a blog. You started a podcast. You wrote books. Now you're the editor of a magazine, like, and you're a huge advocate and you're a speaker. You're going around and you're speaking about this stuff. That's so brave. Because you know, as a speaker, every time people hear your story, they have different questions. And those questions prompt you then to be like, oh, wait, I don't know if I have the answer to that. Or maybe it takes you to a different place. Was there any question, when you did your speaking events, was there any question that really had you in a deep thought or gave you like another recovery type of moment?
I think that question was the biggest one that I was like, oh, wow. You know, sometimes I don't know why things happen. I don't know how I survived a lot. But then I go back and say, wait, no, I do. I lost myself a lot along the way of my life, thinking that I had everything handled. You know, I'm good. I'm fine. I could do it. But it all circles back to the amount of times that I should not be here. And I have to just focus on that. Like, this is why I'm so passionate about what I do. And it doesn't make money. And I was always chastised about that. Well, you're not getting paid. Why are you always paying to do these things? And I say, you know, it's not always about that. You know, sure, I would love to, but I'm given this opportunity to do these things. And it fuels me. Because if I can save someone's life, then that's why I do it. Sometimes I have to remember that 8 hours, 10 hours behind a computer doesn't solve every problem. But when I dig into something, I'm like, it's got to happen right now. I got to do it right now. The story must go out. The interview must be done. The article has to be written, like it has to be done. But it does, it consumes you. So I have to remember that if it doesn't happen today, it'll happen tomorrow. But I think that's just why I'm so passionate right now. My kids see it. They know what mom does. And although they don't like to see it all over social media sometimes, because I have been spoken to about that by my kids, I think later they'll realize why I share so much. Because someone's always watching, reading, listening. They always are. So it's God. It really is. There's no other way I would have survived the things that I have.
I love how passionate you are. And I know when you get passionate, you lose yourself in what you're doing. But I love that you're able to like look in from the outside and be like, wait, there's a balance here and I still need to take care of myself. Yes, I want to help other people. But I love that you found that it's important to take care of you. That's a huge sign like that you have healed and you are healing and it's a forever journey, yes. But that self-worth, I mean, like you said, you put your faith in God. And just sometimes it gets really tough to just be like, okay, yeah, there is a path for me, because we love to tell our own story. And oh boy, do we get stuck in that. There is a stuck point, right?
No, you're right. Yeah.
Just being able to have faith that there is a path and not get stressed and not feel like we have to be someone that we're not. Or like you said, about having that piece of paper to show our worth, just knowing that who we are and our gift that we were put on this earth to share is enough.
It's hard. It took a long time. It took a very long time to realize that I'm just as good. I just had another mission.
It's true. So what would you tell young women in the military, or young women that are thinking about going into the military or transitioning out of the military? What advice would you give them?
So going in is hard because I didn't want my daughter to do it. But, you know, if she would have picked that path, or if my son would have decided to do it as well, we would have supported him. But always I would tell people is to remember who you are and to always use your voice, because we lose that a lot when we serve. In anything, I think. Anything we do, we lose ourselves and we don't use our voice enough. And transitioning out, we have to remember that we're still worthy. No matter what happens, we are still worthy. And that's very difficult too, especially when you don't get a promotion or you don't get that raise. And you're like, what the heck, man? I just gave you everything that I could give you and I'm still not being recognized. Stand up for yourself. And if they don't want to listen, then go and be heard somewhere else. No one's telling you to stay in that slot. And it's hard to leave. But you have to realize that I think right now when we see all these tragedies happening around us, life is just day to day, man. Like, we don't know anymore. We have to make decisions for ourselves more often. And when it comes to, you know, the entrepreneurial route, that is not easy as well. But I try to tell people, do what sets your soul on fire. No matter what you do, you have to do what you want. You might not make that money right away, but if that's what your passion is, you have to do it, because it'll stick with you forever. A regret, I wish I would have done it. I wish I would have done it. You don't want to wish anymore. You know, go try it. You don't have to go all in. Just like a little piece at a time. I had to figure things out. I was told all the time, well, if you pay for this course, or if you get this coach, or if you invest thousands of dollars, you know how many times I did not do that? I always found another way. I'm going to learn how to do it myself. I don't want to be taken advantage of. So I'm going to learn. Took me a little bit longer, but I'm not in it to make a quick. I need to do it because I want to do it, not because I have to.
Yeah. And look at you now. You're the author of the bestseller, The Wall Between Two Lives, right? It's that perseverance. And I believe when you do things, like you said, that set your soul on fire, that you are passionate about, things do just, you get guided in that way. And you're like, okay, yeah, this is where I'm supposed to be. Things really just open up when you do things for the right reasons. And Annette, you are a mother, a veteran, an advocate, a speaker, an author, a beautiful soul of a woman. And so I want to thank you again for being on Dog Tag Diaries, for being so vulnerable, and for taking time out of your schedule to come on our podcast and talk about all this. Because again, I know you have influenced so many people, and now coming on another platform to do that as well. I could just tell your dedication, your passion, your love for who you are and your gift in life and for God and for other humans. So thank you again for being on Dog Tag Diaries.
Thank you so much, really. I truly appreciate it.
That's a wrap on today's episode of Dog Tag Diaries. As we head deeper into season 5, I'm more grateful than ever for this community, for the raw, brave stories shared and the hearts they reach. If something spoke to you today, pass it on. Leave a review, share with a sister in arms, because healing is contagious and so is hope. Until next time, keep speaking your truth and remember, you're not alone.